3 years after Midori Goto made her debut with the New York Philharmonic, the New York Times ran a front-page story describing her first performance at Tanglewood with the headline, Girl, 14, Conquers Tanglewood with Three Violins. That was 27 years ago, and today she's one of the world's most in-demand musicians and music educators. This year, Midori is celebrating her 30th year as a performer and the 20th anniversary of Midori and Friends, an organization she founded that brings quality music education to underserved school children. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Midori back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Happy New Year.
A happy New Year to you. I read that Leonard Bernstein knelt at your feet after that performance at Tanglewood. Is that true?
Well, so that's how the story goes. But, of course, you know, it's hard for me to remember. But
you don't remember what he said to you?
I actually remember being, you know, just so surrounded by his warmth. And that's what I remember the most.
Well, you're celebrating your 30th anniversary, but couldn't it just as easily be your 35th or something like that? Your first public performance was in Osaka at the age of six, wasn't it? Where you played 24 Caprices of Paganini?
Well, something six? Like that. Something like that. Yes, I think I was quite young, and I played one of the Paganini Caprices. And yeah, well.
And then you moved to New York because you were pursuing you thought it would be a better place to pursue your musical career?
My mother actually brought me to the Aspen Music Festival in the summer of 1981. And then from there, we followed on somehow. And I started to study at the pre-college division at the Juilliard School for a few years. And
for your audition, you played Bach's Chaconne, which has to be one of the most difficult violin pieces of all time.
It is, and it is one of the most beautiful, of course. Mm.
So you felt it was okay for you at the age of, what was that, 89?
I was 10 when I first came to live in New York with my mother.
And then you made your first noted public appearance with Zubin Mehta 30 years ago, New York Philharmonic. Did you understand just how important that event was?
I was very excited to be able to play with an orchestra. To be on stage with so many people together making music collaboratively, this was such an excitement for me. This excitement that I feel going out on stage and making music and performing and presenting the music that I love so much, it's something that actually has never changed.
Well, how did you get the opportunity to perform with Zubin Mehta? Did he hear you play somewhere else?
I think it was just a couple months after my mother and I lived. My mother and I moved to New York City. I had an opportunity to meet and play for Maestro Mehta, and just half a year later, played with the orchestra.
Your mother was your first teacher, so I take it she was pretty good on her own right. Was she a professional musician?
My mother was a professional violinist and a teacher.
And what, in your opinion, makes a good music teacher? If you were looking for a music teacher for your kids, what would you look for?
I think it's very difficult to say because everyone's different and every child is different. Every teacher is different. Every relationship is different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but some people are really hard taskmasters. Others are very gentle. Do you have a preferred approach? Or do you think some kids need to be wrapped across the knuckles where other ones need a lot of loving kindness?
I think it really depends. I do love to teach myself. And I think, you know, I could be considered as both.
You're a disciplinarian sometimes. Was it your decision to play the violin or was it your parents?
In a way, it was my decision because I wanted to play this instrument. Not the piano, but the instrument that my mother was always practicing. I think there was a hope on my mother's part that I would play the piano.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is interesting to note why people gravitate toward certain instruments and not others. In some cases, it's simply because that was the instrument that they heard the most. But in other cases, some kids want to do something where they bang. Other kids want to blow.
True. In my case, I just was drawn to the sound of the violin.
Parents often ask their teachers how often their kids should practice when they're first learning an instrument. What do you tell them?
Well, in my case, I practiced every day, but a practice every day doesn't have to mean at the very, very beginning 2-3 hours. I think we start with 10 minutes a day and then gradually go on to 20 minutes a day, then on to 45 minutes a day. But I think this consistency is important.
On the other hand, if you push them too hard early, they may resist and not get up to the 40 minutes a day.
I guess that also depends on the child.
So did your performance and recording career materialize after that performance at Carnegie Hall 30 years ago?
Well, actually, my first recital at Carnegie, which happened in 1990, was already, it was recorded live, and that must have been my third disc. Or third or fourth disc that was released. So I was recording prior to that.
But after you did that with Maestro Maeda, did people suddenly come to you and say, we got to sign you up? In those days, there were a number of classical music recording companies. Now, most of them have disappeared, or RCA, Columbia. They're no longer recording classical music the way they used to. They had special divisions in the old days.
I think my career developed very consistently, but very slowly. And it wasn't suddenly that I was performing 80 concerts a year, but it gradually started, and it was consistent.
And how did that affect your schooling? I know there have been studies that say playing an instrument actually helps children with their academics.
Well, I don't know about that for me, but I did go to school and I always enjoyed learning very much. My enjoyment of the learning isn't restricted just to music. So I was particularly interested in social sciences, particularly in history, literature. And I went to a regular school, which also allowed for absences and for assignments to be sent in. Back in those days, it was very rare, I think, to be homeschooled, and I certainly didn't have that option. So I went to a regular school 5 days a week, the Upper West Side school.
And then instead of studying music on college level, you studied psychology. You went to the Gallatin School at NYU, got a degree in, well, I guess at Gallatin is more like a concentration in psychology, but then you got your a graduate degree in psychology as well?
That is correct. I actually took a little time off after I graduated from high school, concertized, and then went back to college as an adult student, so they say, a few years later. And I had no idea at that point what I wanted to major in or to have a concentration in, but through the general studies, through the liberal arts education, I basically fell upon psychology, fell in love with it, and wanted to pursue it.
And how does that, do you apply it at all to the other things that you do these days? Because your career is musical, you're not seeing patients or anything in psychology.
I think it was a very practical training. In fact, I cherish the college education that I received and the graduate school, too, that it really broadened my horizons and it really started to open me up to different interests in a very serious way. I love being in the academia and also the interdisciplinary approach that was available and really encouraged at Gallatin was something that I embraced.
My guest is Midori, who's celebrating her 30th anniversary as a performer, but also the 20th anniversary of Midori and Friends. Can you tell us about how you came to create that?
Midori and Friends actually was started in 1992 to bring music to children. Most of our work is in the schools, in the public schools, in the inner city, though our programs are not restricted to just in-school services. And we actually don't promote one particular type of music or work with one genre of music.
So it's okay to you if kids play rock or jazz?
We actually try to reflect the diversity that this city has. And, of course, at that time, I was still living in New York City and really saw the wonderful different musical traditions, cultural traditions that the children really would love to learn.
So this is similar to poets in the school or writers in the school, where musicians go into the schools and help kids develop an interest in music or learn how to play an instrument?
Right now, our main work is in general education, general music education. To supplement this, there are performances, there are instrumental programs, after-school programs and such, but our main work is in general music education.
And these are in underserved schools?
Most of them are.
So that's because these are kids who are least likely to get a music education. Many years ago, I had a great jazz musician, Chico Hamilton, here, and I asked him about why so many incredible jazz musicians came out of his high school in Los Angeles in the early 40s. Charlie Mingus and Buddy Collette, and there was a whole bunch of people. And he said, well, the reason was that music was a requirement, and so we all had to take it, and some kids did well, and that became their career. But now there are practically no schools where music is a requirement.
I think that music, in some ways, is being required in many of the schools now. It's not just about the existence of music education, but the quality in which it's delivered that is also important.
What about New York schools? Have things changed since Mayor Bloomberg took over the schools?
I think that some things are going better. I think the climate for accepting music education in the schools, this is much more widely accepted. Quality, I think, you know, that's so difficult to assess in a way, and it's also a long-range planning that you need to do. One doesn't actually accomplish in half a year or 1 year or even 2 years, but it's a long-range planning that one must have a vision in order to be able to carry out quality music education programs and not to expect the results right away.
Now, you have moved to Los Angeles, teaching at USC. Have you brought the program there, or does the program continue here in New York City?
The programs continue here in New York City. The organization works solely in New York City schools and also in organizations.
Now, I don't know whether you teach because it seems to be getting more and more difficult to make a living as a classical musician or even a jazz and rock musician today unless you have a big hit. So an awful lot of well-known musicians teach. I don't know. Do you teach because you just feel the need to teach, or is this what people have to do to get by?
I teach because I love to teach. I'm given opportunities to teach, and I consider it an honor to be able to teach. Mm. And I get so much inspiration working with the young people.
How do you encourage students to listen to music that they are predisposed not to listen to? You're going to say, okay, I'm going to play something by Bach right now.
Well, I think one just plays things, sometimes without an introduction, and sometimes the music speaks for itself.
So do you don't face a lot of resistance from the kids?
Well, actually, at USC, I teach violin. Mm-hmm. And I teach in the music department. I actually am the department chair for the strings department.
You also operate Partners in Performance, another nonprofit. What is that?
Partners in Performance, we call it PIP for short, and it brings high-quality chamber music performances, particularly in the recital format, to the smaller towns of the U.S., working in partnership with community-minded presenters.
Now, you have also encouraged new compositions, and you've been somebody who has happily played some of the more modern composers, but you've referred to Bach as the teacher.
Well, I think a Bach, you know, to play a Bach work is just so challenging. And yes, it does teach us a lot about, you know, our own playing, about our own selves. It's just miraculous.
In fact, we had Paul Ely here last year when his book was published about how Bach has influenced everybody. You've been in conversation with him as well.
Just very briefly, yes.
So do you think that, like Louis Armstrong, people say every singer of the 20th century was influenced by Louis Armstrong, whether they knew it or not. You think every musician, whether they're a rock guitarist or whatever, is somehow influenced by Bach?
I think Bach is the one, yes.
Do you ever think about playing things other than classical music?
I actually listen to a fair amount of non-classical music. I don't particularly play any other genre. I was not particularly trained, and so therefore don't feel comfortable performing in other genres.
But when you hear Stephan Grappelli or Steph Smith or something like that,
it's wonderful stuff.
You can't help but saying, but admiring how wonderfully they played. Well, congratulations. Two anniversaries, the 30th anniversary of your performing career and the 20th anniversary of Midori and Friends. Thank you so much for stopping by to talk about them. And let's listen to a little bit of a performance. I don't exactly know what we're going to be going out with. Debussy, not a bad composer.
Thank you.